Electronic devices whacked a number of industries upside the head in recent years. Publishing is one of them. It's a story similar to the story in the music business. Why buy CDs or books in a store when you can get them online, often for free? It sure makes a challenge for people trying to make money, but think about the other side. With texts and tweets and blogs, lots of people are writing now who didn't used to write that much. Today's guests are both writing now and have been for a long time. Both are published authors. One is the co-founder of a publishing company. Molly Best Tinsley is retired from a long stint teaching at the U.S. Naval Academy. She's the co-founder of Ashland-based Fuse Publishing and the author of several books and plays, including a textbook she co-authored, The Creative Process. Welcome, Molly Best Tinsley.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. James Sulzer is one of the writers in the stable at Fuse Publishing, though he lives across the country on Nantucket. He teaches reading and writing to middle school kids and is also a published author several times over and the author of The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson. Thank you for joining us, Jim Sulzer.
Thank you.
So we can assume the two of you do know each other before you came into this room.
Yes.
Tell us, Molly, the story of how you guys got to know each other.
Well, actually, Jim would be probably better able to tell you that because he comes to us through my partner, Coretta Hubbard, my partner in the small press. And I only know him first through his work, and then I met him for the first time this morning.
Oh, all right, right here outside the studios.
Well, there have been emails, you know, sure. Electronically I know him.
All right. So, yeah. Jim, tell us the story about how you got connected to Fuse Publishing.
Well, I'd been published in a number of other places, and then through a family member, I was introduced again online to Coretta Hubbard, told her about this novel I was writing about Emily Dickinson. She was interested in it. I'd worked on it for a number of years. Sent her a copy, and she said, well, yes, pretty good, but what about this, this, and that? So I did a whole rewrite over the next year, sent it back, and then the real editing process started, which was great. So it's the honed-down Emily Dickinson, the story that was always within the granite, you know, but it's been chipped away to the essence now.
Is it considerably shorter than it had been
originally? Yeah, well, at one point, even before I sent it to her, it was over 500 pages. I had a whole modern section, too, about people living in seclusion like Emily Dickinson, and I tried to connect it all. It was too ambitious for one novel to do. So I'd already thrown that part out, but I had a number of other sections just of her life that later I came to also chisel away. But the best scenes, some of them remained almost word for word as I wrote them. That's part of the creative process, I think. You know, sometimes you're just on and you hit it. Other times you've got to whittle away and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite it. It varies.
In a case like this where you're trying to recreate history or suggest a history that probably or might not have happened anyway, is it almost like you're trying hard to understand what got said in that room? You're trying to listen a little better as a writer?
Absolutely. Basically, I read all of her poems and letters for a year and a half. I sort of became obsessed for a while, which you have to do if you're going to write a book like this. And then I came to know so many of her poems so well that they sort of lived in me. And then I wanted to write a novel about her, which involved needing to come up with a new theory of her life because there were some mysteries that simply were not being explained by current theories. So I went through that whole process, and then the actual writing of it, when I got to actually you don't say pen to paper anymore, fingers to computer. Anyway, mm-hmm. It was wonderful to actually get to that point, but I knew there was a couple years of work before I could even do that. And so it was sort of trying to enter that life. Again, it's a subjective viewpoint, one person's viewpoint, just my own.
Let's talk about Fuse Publishing then, Molly. You are the co-founder of that. It is, I guess we could say, based in Ashland, but our company's really based anyplace anymore when I see that, like, your accounting officer is in the Virginia suburbs or something?
That's right, and our shipping department is a stay-at-home mom in Petaluma, California. Our newsletter comes out of Petaluma, and our mailbox is here in Ashland, and that's the defining thing. And also, you have to have a legal status somewhere. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we started this four and a half years ago, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. Coretta and I had collaborated on a spy thriller for fun, and it was fun, and I kind of enjoyed the genre. But when it came time to publish it, we had the recession going on, and big publishing was kind of frozen to new authors. I'm not a new author, but I had never ventured into spy thrillers before, so I didn't have a track record. And, of course, publishing it isn't just electronics that have changed publishing. Publishing changed back in the 90s, even the 80s, when business people kind of invaded the industry and marketing took it over. I mean, it's as simple as that. There, we now have five, you probably know this, but five corporations own all of the publishing imprints. And they're mega corporations. They're not publishing corporations.
It's interesting to read. I know when we're looking for credits for pictures for the website, for example, that you're looking for, you find the name of the publisher, and it's like, well, no, this is an imprint of this, which is an imprint of that. Right. It ultimately comes back to Penguin or Random House or HarperCollins.
Right. And all of those big ones, Random House, Doubleday, Bantam, et cetera, are all owned by a German corporation called Bertelsmann. And, of course, Penguin is in England and owns Viking and Pelican and a zillion others.
Was there any trepidation about starting a publishing house, or did you start it because you wanted to be an alternative to the big places?
We wanted to be an alternative, and there was trepidation, and justly so. It's been a huge enterprise. Our learning curve has been dizzying. But it's also produced lots of rewards. We have 12 books out, and we have two coming out sometime this year, and a third one kind of in the consideration stage. So, yeah.
All right. Much more to talk about the publishing business and about their individual books in particular. We have Molly Tinsley and James Sulzer with us here on the Jefferson Exchange, both in the stable at Fuse Publishing, where Molly is also the co-founder. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Molly and James and take your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking about writing and publishing today with two people who are both actively involved in the process. Molly Best Tinsley, a published author. Her most recent book, Broken Angels, is a spy thriller. And Molly also has a memoir out from a couple of years ago called Entering the Blue Stone. She is the co-founder of Ashland-based Fuse Publishing. As we point out, Ashland-based is a sort of a subjective term. It's where the post office box is anyway, as Molly's pointed out. One of the other authors in the Fuse stable is Jim Sulzer from Nantucket. He's the author of The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson. He has a reading tonight in Ashland at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books. You can join us here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking, Molly, about the dizzying learning curve of getting Fuse Publishing up to speed. How long has it been?
4.5 years we've been working on this. But just book production and then, of course, the financial side of it and dealing with authors and taking on social media. That's been huge for people that are kind of not electronically inclined. We're now Facebooking and tweeting and Pinteresting and that sort of thing.
I noticed too, because we do interview a fair number of authors here on the Exchange, that there seems to be a trailer for every book now.
Yeah.
Coming out of the big houses anyway. I don't know if you've gotten into that realm of things.
We've got our trailers too. Yeah, we've not, and our website, I didn't even mention. The trailers are you can sort of click to the trailers on the website.
I guess the biggest question then is, are people reading any less? It seems like with all the stuff they have access to on the internet, people are reading as much or more than they used to.
I think so, yeah. I think people are reading quite avidly, particularly in genre work. I mean, I think areas like science fiction and romance and historical fiction have been really burgeoning with this sort of absence of a gatekeeper, which has occurred with self-publishing and blogging and that sort of thing.
And at Fuse Publishing, do you tend to put out limited runs of books? I mean, is it pretty small first printing?
Yeah, we do a small first printing, and then we do e-books. Mm-hmm. And we sell a lot of e-books.
Are the e-books the primary part of things? Or do you do that more than the paper books?
You know, I don't have the numbers on that. I would think that it's probably about half and half. That's my guess.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about, as authors, how you choose subjects. And as I understand with you, James Sulzer, with Emily Dickinson, the fascination goes back quite a few years.
It does, right. I started well, you know, everyone discovers someone like Emily Dickinson differently. I was maybe 16 or 17, and I was reading through some collection of poetry, and I found this poet, Emily Dickinson, whom I'm ashamed to admit I'd never heard of, and I immediately felt this voice from her that just captivated me. So my final year in high school, I for a project, I took 10 of her poems and set them to music. I was a guitarist, you know, and wrote them and produced them and all that, you know, in my home little studio with my four-track, you know, reel to reel. Went to college, of course, read her some there, studied. And then after college, I was working at WGBH in Boston, and I made some poetry tapes of her with professional readers and music. But then I really didn't get to the book stage until years later. I didn't know it at the time. I had a herniated disc. I had this terrible pain in my back, especially down my leg. And so one summer after school was out, I basically just had to lie around. And I tried reading a lot of things. I read all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's short stories and didn't like one of them.
And then, it took you a while to figure that out, though.
Yeah, it took me a while. Yeah, I was a slow learner still. But then I went back to Emily Dickinson, and that, it was immediate again. So I read all of her poems, all of her letters, number of biographies, and then sort of became obsessed for the next year and a half, and just until that sort of became, you know, I set up a dwelling within her universe, I guess. I don't know. And then from there, it was natural to want to write a book, a novel, to try to create a novel that would have the same aesthetic sense of being inside one of her poems. So if you read the novel, you feel as if you're in a poem. So I was borrowing some of her phrases, but also using my own voice, borrowing some of her actual poems and letters, and trying to weave it all together into a fabric that would, you know, that would make something magical, hopefully.
From the sounds of the editing process you already described, you had a 500-page book, and then you went back and turned it into less than a 200-page book.
Yeah.
Have you essentially written this book two or three times?
Well, the transitions I've written two or three times. The seminal scenes, a lot of them are as they came out originally. But how you put those together is a tricky process. For instance, how much of her childhood do you show? How much of her adulthood? And then, of course, I had a number of other characters set in a whole different alternate universe that was the present that I've decided to get rid of. But even just staying within her world, stitching it together, the transitions, how do you start a book? My editor, Sarah Plato, came up with the idea of having a prologue at the beginning, which I loved. And it gave me the chance to then use one of my favorite poems of her, A Bird Came Down the Walk, to sort of set her up in the prologue, trying to describe a bird. And so she's looking at the eye of a bird that's coming down the walk, and she's trying to, how can you describe what this bird's eye looks like? And then she realizes, oh, it looks like her eyes, the eyes of this bird look like frightened beads, which is just a great description of a, if you think about a bird, like a picture any robin or a sparrow, the eyes do look mm-hmm. like frightened beads. So I was trying to start the book with that moment of sort of creative inspiration of using words that are used all the time, but in images that no one else has done. And that's what I was trying to get to with her. She was seeing the world anew.
What is the basic premise, then, of The Voice at the Door, and how much is it based on things that actually did happen? She did meet the person who
right.
The affair is
well, in. Okay, so you mentioned affair. Okay. okay, so there are three great mysteries at the heart of Emily Dickinson's life. She was born in 1830. In 1860 to 1863, she wrote her great love poetry, agonized, despairing, ecstatic, you know, incredible images. That's one mystery. Who was that for? Man or woman? There's a lot of theories. Second, and this is less known about Emily Dickinson, she had a spell of blindness or partial blindness right at the end of that period, 1863 to 1865, where she actually had to go to Cambridge, Massachusetts for 6 months one year and seven the next to get treatment from an eye specialist to restore her vision. And then finally, what we all know is her physical reclusiveness. She wrote letters all the time during that. She wasn't reclusive from the world, but she was certainly physically reclusive. Very few people saw her in those last 25 years of her life. So I needed a theory that would describe all three of those. And it is now thought that her blindness was anterior uveitis, and the main cause of it at that time would have been syphilis. So obviously there would have been an affair or a relationship. She had met... The Reverend Charles Wadsworth was an older man, a married man, famous, perhaps the second most famous preacher in America at the time. She did meet him, it is thought, in 1855, coming back from Washington where her father was serving in Congress. He did visit her for sure in 1860 and in 1880 at the homestead, her father's house where she lived. And basically this book assumes that there was first an emotional affair and then an actual physical affair, at least one meeting. And there's a number of clues about his life as well. For instance, he and his wife were married for 12 years before they had any children. Typically at that time, the great plague of the time was syphilis. This is before penicillin. There was no cure. A man perhaps would get syphilis at some point early in his life, then get married, pass it on to his wife, probably unknowing and unfortunate wife, who would then come down with syphilis. She could not bear healthy children for a period of X number of years until the disease passed into its latent stage. So that little details like that would also fit in with this theory.
Did you have any trepidation about making a book about Emily Dickinson? Because you feel very strongly about her, but so do lots of other people.
Right.
And I can just imagine they could be like, well, how could you write something like this about Emily Dickinson?
I did have trepidation. And I knew that it was just one. I looked upon this theory as pretty far out there, but a way to open a door into Emily Dickinson that had not been opened before. But partly to preserve that distance, I have a little section at the beginning that talks about discovering this manuscript. My uncle, William Norcross, was obsessed with Emily Dickinson, and he was a doctor, an expert on infectious disease. I found this manuscript after he died. You know, that whole thing. It's used by, Hawthorne for the Custom House papers.
Oh, right,
and all
the beginning of the Scarlet Letter.
The Scarlet Letter, all that. So it's a well-known, device. But I did that partly to try to create a separation. And just to because I felt this theory was out there, and I needed to sort of set it off at a distance. So that's one way that I tried to accomplish that. But also, I feel, and I did worry about the theory would seem out there to some people. But there are many, many theories about Emily Dickinson now, and they're all of out there in one way or another. So really, it's sort of a level playing field in that way. She's such a mystery. No one really knows what happened, except we all know she wrote this poetry that is just astonishing.
Mm-hmm. And grips a lot of people.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing I can say, I felt total respect for her and her writing as I wrote this book. I was, really trying to honor her and also to make her an active, to give her the personality that you would have to write this amazing poetry, the active, brilliant, charming, sometimes, innocent, but I wanted her to be a powerhouse because she was.
James Sulzer is the author of The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson. He'll be reading parts of it tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange Here and Now. He is one of the authors in the stable at Fuse Publishing, for which Molly Best Tinsley is an author and also a co-founder. And you can join us here in the Exchange as we talk about writing and publishing in today's world. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I noticed in your bios, Molly, that you're described as the first professor emerita at the Naval Academy. So the first woman professor to retire from the civilian side?
I guess that's what that means. Well, to retire and then be given that honor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It doesn't mean a lot to me, to tell you the truth. I mean, teaching there did, but...
But the point is,
you
worked at the Naval Academy long enough to retire from it and be named a professor.
Well, I didn't actually retire. I quit. Oh. I mean, 20 years. In fact, lots of people told me I was being very unwise because my pension wouldn't do this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
But I was ready. Mm-hmm. I was ready to move on to something else. I wanted to write full time. And, time runs out on your life. So I stopped. It was 20 years exactly. And so I didn't collect a pension or whatever until just recently.
And so how much writing did you get to do when you were teaching over the course of that 20 years? Was it really shoved to the side?
It was shoved to the side to some extent, but, as a professor, you get summers off, and I also was able to take leave without pay, and I was also able to have a couple of sabbaticals in that 20 years. And I just write, that's all. I mean, I just do it. So I did publish a novel and short stories during that period, and I wrote another one that never got published. And then I came out here. I wrote some plays, came out here, and started writing everything.
I should point out that you're also a contributor to the Jefferson Monthly, the magazine put out monthly.
I just finished
Jefferson
my
Public
review
Radio.
On The Tempest.
All right. For the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah.
Okay. Can't wait to see that.
Very nice production.
How do you choose subject matter for your books? I mean, did you ever have an Emily Dickinson obsession yourself?
No, I haven't had an. I haven't been obsessed with my subject quite. Though I have found that the spy thriller genre really, there's something, it really sort of clicks with, I think, my paranoid conspiracy tendencies. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives me an outlet for that sort of imagining the machinations that are going on while we sleep.
The stuff that global, we're not aware of
globally,
that affects us.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think that a lot of what we imagine is actually going on. I mean, there is a paranoid, I do have a paranoid streak. And when I really wanted to write Broken Angels about the subject of human trafficking. And my idea with writing in general is that at the same time that you're entertaining and grabbing a reader and sort of having them turn pages, you can be also educating in some way. So there is a lot of research that went into this book about human trafficking and also about Ukraine. I could have told you that this was going to happen. The sort of Russian-Ukrainian split. The thing that the U.S. media doesn't emphasize, though, is that the other side of Ukraine are pretty right-wing.
Pretty right-wing, right. Very industrial, yes. And Russian speakers, whereas Western Ukraine tends to be Ukrainian speakers.
No, the Ukrainian speakers are right-wing.
Oh,
and
okay.
The people that are in this sort of improvised government now, there are a lot of extremists.
Mm-hmm.
So that I'm not sure which government is going to answer the needs of the people. And we have to remember, too, that membership in the EU for Ukraine would have turned them into another Spain or Greece. I mean, this is not a country that's going to enter the EU with ribbons and flowers and candy. You know, it's...
Oh, they would have entered
case. It's a very complicated situation that the media, I don't think, covers. Well, we have this villainization of Russia going on.
Mm-hmm.
That we just couldn't let go of when the Berlin Wall came down. We had to figure out ways to resurrect it, and I think that's happening a bit.
Interesting take on the Russia-Ukraine situation. The recurring character of Victoria Pierce, who is the main character in Broken Angels, I mean, how fun is it to come back to somebody you've dealt with before?
It is. A lot of the work feels as though it's already done. The one issue for me in writing a sequel was wondering how much of the earlier novel, Satan's Chamber, needed to be included to make the characters understandable, their backstory and so on. You sort of don't want to repeat too much for people who have read the other book, but people who haven't read the other book have to know what's going on.
I've often wondered about
that
process.
So that's just a technical issue that you have to deal with. I'm not sure I managed it as gracefully as I might have.
I've noticed that, too, when reading, for example, the second or third or, you know, 15th or 16th in some of these detective novel series cases where you're meeting a character for the first time because you just picked it up here. So the author has to write for you, but also has to write for the people who can appreciate this character from the past. That's a tricky business. James Seltzer, what do we know of, we know of Emily Dickinson's poetry. She left a lot of letters behind, too, didn't she?
Yes, there's the hundreds and hundreds of letters to about 100 different people. Many of her letters were destroyed at her death by her sister at her bequest. And so a lot of the mystery of what I'm recreating probably went up in flames at that time. But there are three of the letters that survive are the master letters, all of which I included here. And, of course, Harvard owns her poems and letters, so I had to pay Harvard for this, but they were reasonable about it. The three master letters are astonishing. They are so extremely passionate and gripping, and it is not known again who dear master is. She does mention a beard. She mentions, you know, hair on his chest and things like that. So it's presumably a man. Although there is debate about that. And the only candidate that I saw to be the recipient of those letters was the Reverend Charles Wadsworth.
Interesting. And so in addition to the stuff that was lost, weren't there also court battles at some point over
who
had the domain over Emily Dickinson's papers?
Huge battle. And that's one reason that these poems are still owned by Harvard, because Harvard actually did a great service, two of their scholars, over the last 50 years of restoring her original punctuation and giving us Emily Dickinson, as she left them, and now further, these poems are becoming available online as well in her original handwriting through Harvard and through Amherst, which is great. But not to go too long into the split, but basically, after her death, Emily's sister Vinnie wanted to publish some of the poems, and she talked to their sister-in-law, Susan, who was married to the brother, Austin. And Susan had some of the poems from letters from Emily. Vinnie found some.
Okay, let's take a break there because we need to move to an underwriting break at the moment, and we'll come back and pick up the story there. So two sets of letters, two sets of people anyway, seeking domain over the letters of Emily Dickinson. James Sulzer is the author of The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson. Molly Beth Tinsley, the author of Broken Angels and several other books, and the co-founder of Fuse Publishing. We'll talk more with both of them about writing and publishing in today's world and take your phone calls and emails. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about writing and publishing with a couple of writers, one of whom is also a publisher. Our guests are Molly Beth Tinsley and James Sulzer. Molly Beth Tinsley is the author most recently of Broken Angels, a spy thriller featuring her recurring character Victoria Pierce. And she is also the co-founder of Ashland-based Fuse Publishing. Ashland-based Fuse Publishing is the publisher of the book The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson by James Sulzer, who is also our guest here in the studio, visiting from the East Coast. He has a reading tonight of the book and similar materials at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. You can join us here in the Exchange now to talk about writing and publishing process and future. The numbers here in the Exchange, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking before the break, Jim, about the domain of the papers of Emily Dickinson and how strange that got.
Very complicated process. There were three siblings. Austin was the oldest, then Emily, and then Vinny. At Emily's death, Vinnie wanted to publish poems, and she went to Susan, who was married to Austin, and Susan at the time didn't want to cooperate. So then Vinnie went to Mabel. Mabel Loomis Todd was Austin's mistress, 30 years younger than Austin, rather scandalous. And so Mabel, Austin's mistress, I hate to use an old-fashioned word, but that's what she was called at the time, worked with the sister, Vinnie, to publish some poems. Then Susan decided to publish other poems. Then there was, in addition to that, there was a land dispute between Mabel Loomis Todd, whose husband owned property next to the Dickinsons, and that blew things up more. So then eventually we ended up with two separate editions of Emily Dickinson poems being published, one by Vinnie and Mabel, the other by Susan. And it went on for years. One group left things to Amherst, one group left things to Harvard. One group has the hair that remains. One group has the table, the writing table. I mean, both. And now, Harvard, to give them credit, they did restore her punctuation. They did a lovely job of that. But now both Harvard and Amherst are starting to put her original poems online, which is wonderful. Amherst wanted to make it all open source. Harvard has made it free for scholarly uses, but not for publication. And so the whole Dickinson poetry is finally coming back into, you know, it's being restored as one, hopefully, in the next 30 or 40 years. There's still disputes about what actually is a poem by Emily Dickinson. If she scratched three lines on the side of an envelope, is that a poem? And I think many people feel yes. In fact, some of her greatest poems may be those late little fragments that are so brilliant. Her letters still remain to go up online, and that's a whole other issue, too. But it's very, very complicated.
You've mentioned a couple of times now the restoring the punctuation. What was unique about Emily Dickinson's punctuation that needed restoring?
Good question. Well, she used a lot of dashes, for one thing. She capitalized words in the middle of a line. A bird came down the walk. Walk might be capitalized. And then she didn't use exact rhymes. I think she liked that the rhymes were not exact. So some of the first editions of her poems not only put in commas and semicolons where she used dashes, but also changed the wording to make the rhyming exact, which is sacrilegious now to any of us,
sure.
But was what they thought they needed to do. And it may be one reason why Thomas Higginson of The Atlantic didn't publish her poetry when he invited her to come visit. The thing about a dash is it's much more, it allows the energy to flow in both directions. A dash does, where a semicolon stops the energy, and I think Emily Dickinson felt that. But it also makes some of it a little indeterminate about which phrase is this actually referring to. In fact, I had my fifth graders and eighth graders read the same poem recently, and they were The fifth graders interpreted one phrase one way, the eighth graders another way. Totally different readings from two different ages of children. It's fascinating.
Interesting, yeah. The brains work differently, or were they just different dynamic leaders in each of those age groups?
Well, that's a great question. I think the fifth graders saw it more holistically. There's a phrase about, in this poem, A Bird Came Down the Walk, like one in danger, cautious, I offered him a crumb. The fifth graders thought the bird was the one in danger, cautious, probably because as fifth graders they know how scary it is to be small. The eighth graders looked at the punctuation and said, no, there's a comma after that dash, so she's the one in danger, cautious, when she's offering the crumb to the bird.
Interesting. Oh, wow. That's quite an observation. We have an email here from Jacob in Gold Hill, and this is aimed toward Molly Tinsley. Does Fuse publish nonfiction? The answer is yes, I know that much. What kinds of help do you offer first-time authors? How long is the process from start to finish? That is, if I were to bring you my manuscript and you accept it, how long before I can begin to push the book? How much does it cost to publish hardcover, paperback, and electronic books? So a bunch of questions in there. We'll keep them on the screen so we can refer back if you need.
Yeah, those are actually probably more than I can cover right here. Let me just say that in our mission statement, we talk about wanting to publish books that tell riveting stories, in other words, stories that are compelling and have propulsion, and also in some way illuminate, so that while the reader is reading, he or she actually walks away having learned something. And we are accepting submissions, and you can write to us at fusepublishing@gmail.com and get a complete answer, I think, to these questions, because it varies so much from one writer to another. Essentially, we're looking for work, though, that is publish ready. We do not do developmental editing. So that might answer your question.
All right, so basically plopping a manuscript right in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we line edit and we copy edit. James Sulzer's situation was somewhat different, I think, because of the nature of the manuscript and the fact that it was one of those offers we couldn't refuse. And so there was some more developmental editing going on before we actually brought out the book.
You talked about how busy you've been with
Fuse
Publishing since it started 4 years ago, which this was meant to be at the time when you had more time to write.
Right.
Has it turned into that for you?
No. Well, it's turned into being an editor, essentially, and being part of this company. And I certainly don't regret it. And my resolution in 2014 was to protect a couple of hours a day for myself to write, because I'm working on another novel myself. And if I don't write, I go a little batty. I'm very hard to live with.
Is it another Victoria Pierce novel?
No, it's not. It's a novel that I started with my twin grandsons, and it's about twins. So it's really for what they call mid-level, I think, for your kids, junior high. And it's fantasy, and they've given me plot points, and I ran it by my other granddaughter, and she decided they needed a sister. So, you know, I'm sort of writing it collectively, and it's been fun.
It's probably more interesting writing for young people these days than for adults. There are some certain things
market.
That adults... Well, it is a huge market, but we were talking before we got on the air about the fact that we've been having some issues with... our junior in high school reading Catcher in the Rye because he thinks it's boring.
Yeah.
When we were in high school, and granted it was a long time ago, Holden Caulfield was a real on-the-edge kind of character. The way he talked and thought and the way his thoughts were expressed was pretty ragged, on the borderline of vulgar. Now, you know, at a time when there's rap and all sorts of other cultural influences around, he's pretty tame by comparison. So given that, I mean, how do you write for a younger audience and not try to sound adult-like or stodgy or something?
Well, maybe this has something to do with the kind of abundance now of fantasy lit. I mean, there's been such a swing over to that genre, so that a lot of the stuff that's coming out for YA and middle grades is it isn't located in the real world. To some extent, to sort of a disturbing extent, a lot of it is dystopian. I mean, I think that the
post-apocalyptic
kids, the kids
like
are responding to the fact that society's a mess, and we have things like the Hunger Games, and which I think is completely metaphorical for what goes on in our society.
So, James Seltzer, you're teaching this very age group we're talking about,
the
fifth to eighth graders. So,
yeah.
I mean, how do you go about choosing the materials they'll read?
Well, I try to do a balance, but. books like To Kill a Mockingbird speak still today as much as they ever did. It's just that I'm reading that right now with the seventh graders. And so, too, does Lord of the Flies, which is one of the original dystopian novels, and I think very disturbing, incredibly brilliant, just incredible. The writing in it is amazing, but the lack of love, or the two nice characters, being put to death by the other boys, it's disturbing. But the kids get it, and it's not as shocking to them as it was to me when I first read it because of all these other dystopian novels that are around. But I also have the seventh graders read Robert Frost, and they get that. They like it. They understand the images. They're simple enough but profound enough for them to get. It is a challenge, but I find that what I do is I read each chapter that they have to read at night. I read it at night also. And so when we go in, we're talking in real depth about the words. In fact, they can even quiz me if they want to get some extra points for the class. Any four words from the chapter, if they read those, and I don't know what it's from, they get a point. So I let them know I'm reading it closely, and they know they have to read it closely too, but it's in a fun sort of informal interchange way back and forth.
I want to talk about research. I mean, obviously, the Emily Dickinson research, there's a lot of material out there to work with, but then you also turned this into a novel, so I had to work and stuff in your own head. But what kind of research do you do into the Victoria Pierce books, Molly?
Very much. I've read a number of books about human trafficking, for one thing, and I also, there is some fundamentalist religion going on in the book, and I've read a lot of books about that as well. Books like Jeff Charlotte's The Family, and my earlier spy thriller, I read about the CIA. It's very hard to find books about the CIA, but I did find one memoir by a young woman who was a junior officer for a while and then actually quit, and that tended to be honest. Most of the memoir type of writing about the CIA is very gung-ho and patriotic and not particularly revealing of the experience. I was going for reality in this. I mean, this is not Jason Bourne. This is somebody who, gets thirsty, has to go to the bathroom, makes mistakes, et cetera.
And doesn't punch 50 people on the way to the bathroom.
Right. And if she gets punched, it hurts and her face is swollen after that and so on. So, yeah, but I really wanted to the choice in this book is that she is on task to do one thing when she encounters the human trafficking going on in Odessa, Ukraine, which it does. And she has to decide whether to stay on task for the CIA or have her, follow her human intuition, which is to help these young women and girls.
Well, not just the people and the circumstances, but the places. I mean, you're fairly well-traveled. You're a military brat yourself, aren't you?
Yeah. But I've never been,
Never been to Ukraine?
I haven't. Mm-hmm. Googling is very instructive. Google Earth will get you.
Sure, right down to street level. Yeah,
get your boots on the ground and photographs and blogs and all of that sort of thing will give you a picture of a country.
You can find out quickly what downtown Odessa looks like, absolutely.
Yeah.
We have a request to say the Fuse Publishing website again. It's F-U-Z-E, fusepublishing.com. Why F-U-Z-E?
Oh, gee. You would have to ask that.
Yes, I would.
Well, when Coretta was actually incorporating this in the state of Virginia, Fuse was already taken with an S. And so she made a quick unilateral executive decision, as business people do, and decided to spell it with a Z. So now a former English professor, have got to answer that question over and over again.
Let's talk in general, though. I mean, as we wrap up here, we have about a minute and a half left. Just to talk about publishing and reading. There's an ongoing argument about whether we're becoming illiterate, where we're just simply not interested in words. But on the other hand, we are texting and tweeting and blogging. And granted, maybe our stuff is in 140-character bursts, but it seems like more people are putting thoughts in a visual format.
Yes, I think to an extent that's true. But the quality, I think you have to ask about the quality at some point. And though I certainly have no affection for legacy publishing, and I do think that even there, the job of editing is kind of deteriorating. It isn't a job that's valued. And so the quality of writing, I think, is kind of sinking. And that's something that we're that's sort of a line we're trying to hold at Fuse. We really are looking for quality writing, and we want to sort of hang on to that, and good editing.
Jim Seltzer, you're working with fifth through eighth graders, and you're trying to instill a sense of writing in them, which is about the time it seems like they're really getting interested in it. Over time, what changes are you noticing there?
I'm finding the kids are still really receptive to good reading and writing, and I think it's basically exposing them to great books and exposing them to great examples of writing, and to really talk to them about writing, to have them really read their writing to each other, to publish it in different ways. I think with the right teaching and the right context, kids are still ready to write really well. They may text one way without capital letters and all that. That's just surface features. I mean, but they're going to write really well if you hold them to the challenge and inspire them.
James Seltzer is the author of The Voice at the Door, a novel of Emily Dickinson. He'll be reading portions of it this evening at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in downtown Ashland. It is published by Fuse Publishing, for which Molly Best Tinsley is the co-founder and also one of the writers in the stable. Her latest book is called Broken Angels. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having
us.
A pleasure. Yeah. And that'll do it for this edition of The Exchange. The takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening in the morning, our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the folks behind the anti-GMO measure in Jackson County. Our Vent Stay segment follows. We'll talk about whether there should be the ability for local jurisdictions to ban marijuana dispensaries. And we'll also take your thoughts on what should be done about the situation in Ukraine. At 9 o'clock tomorrow, we'll talk to the author of No Better Time, a brief life story of a man who changed the Internet. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.